Welcome into the KSRO kitchen today. I'm Steve Garner, and with me is Stanley Ginsberg. Stanley has written Inside the Jewish Bakery, Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking. He co-wrote it with Norman Berg. Norman blankets the East Coast, publicizing the book, and Stanley, who lives in California, takes care of the West Coast duties. And this is perfect timing because in a little over a month, it's Passover. What, April 3rd this year?
I believe it's April 6th, isn't
April,
it?
Sometime in April. And there's a section on Passover baking in the book. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you.
I know you've gotten a lot of great feedback about it. It's a chronicle of Jewish baking and also Jewish history, especially Ashkenazi history, going back 500 years or so. And what you have done is to bring these original master formulas for the first time into a book and scale these down from bakeries so that the home cook can recreate these classic and, unfortunately, long-gone Jewish classic baked goods.
True.
So way to good.
Yep.
So your grandmother was a baker?
My grandmother was a baker. She was a home baker. Both I was very fortunate. Both of my grandmothers were superb cooks. And my mother's mother, we lived in Brooklyn. My mother's parents lived on the fifth floor of the apartment building. We lived on the second floor. And so I was up in my grandma's house as much, if not more, than I was at my parents' house. And whenever she baked, she would give me a piece of dough, and I got to make whatever it was I wanted to make. So I've really been baking for off and on for probably 60 some odd years now.
Did she write down anything?
No.
It was all in her head.
You know, what it was, Grandma, this is wonderful. How do you make it? Well, I take, you know, two or three glasses of flour, and I take a little bit of salt, and I take a little bit of baking powder and some sugar. And when it looks right, then I bake it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's...
Okay.
Right.
And that was the problem in collating all these recipes, because home bakers didn't write these things down, by and large.
True.
But professional bakers had their own baker's shorthand or formulas.
Absolutely. The only thing a baker really ever had was his formulas. And this was, I suppose, what we would call today intellectual property. And what it was really about, the only thing of value that a baker had was his formulas and his know-how. And so bakers were very, very stingy about sharing their
secretive
formulas. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
How did you gain access to these proprietary formulas?
I was fortunate enough to find a retired baker, Norm, started baking literally out of high school. He went to high school in the Bronx to Food Trades High School, where he learned to be a baker. And at age 17, he got his first job at a Jewish bakery in the Bronx, and had been working ever since. And several years ago, some health problems forced him to retire. But he has still literally thousands of these formulas, pieces of paper, just, you know, notebooks, just all of, we have a photograph in the book of one of the pages of one of his formulas for chiffon cake.
I love that because it had his scribbles, and then there was an underline, and I learned that the underline means mix here.
Correct.
So that was, I've never seen anything quite like that.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, either an underline or a blank line means you will mix here, and generally they never included baking instructions because it was pretty clear. If you're doing a cake, depending on the size of the pan and the thickness of the cake, you would bake it at either 375, 350, or 325. Mm-hmm. And they were just and bakers they knew. And over the years, he worked with a lot of different old school bakers, and many of whom did share their formulas. And often, you know, you're a young baker, you stand there and you watch, or they have you mixing the doughs and they have you mixing the batters.
Have you gotten feedback from any of these surviving old Jewish bakers
around
the country, these guys in their 80s and 90s?
Yes, absolutely. I got an email not too long ago from a retired baker in Atlanta, whose family has been in the baking business for a long time. In fact, he's quoted in the book. And he said, when the book came in the mail, my hands started shaking. And when I opened it up, I couldn't put it down. Your memories are mine.
And he grew up in New York, or?
He grew up in New York, and then they moved down to Atlanta, and his family still owns a large wholesale bakery. But
I mean, he must have felt, I haven't seen these recipes in 50 years.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is true of a lot of the people. You know, that it is impossible to find these things anymore. And unfortunately, a lot of those products, you know, if they are available, they are manufactured by large industrial bakers, large wholesale bakers. And oftentimes one of the things that happens is that the technology of food production, because so much of it is automated, typically demands that a baker make compromises on ingredients and techniques. Mm-hmm. And I think probably the most obvious example is the bagel.
Oh, we'll get into that.
Okay, good. Yes.
That was a real eye-opener.
Yes.
When you put the book together, it's only been out since about fall of 2011.
Yeah, it came out in October.
So it's a very new book.
Yeah.
So it was almost in time for the high holidays of 2011 or not quite?
No, it was late.
Afterwards.
It came in late.
But it'll be in, obviously, for Passover.
Oh, yes,
it's
exactly.
Perfect.
Yes.
The first chapter is called Vanished Worlds, where you talk about the Jewish diaspora, basically, of the Ashkenazi Eastern European Jews.
And, yes, exactly.
And a lot of the history of the Jewish migration throughout this time. But how important the baker was throughout these past 500-600 years. There always was a baker.
Yes, always.
Somewhere.
Always. Always.
And how important the baker was to the Jewish life. And how hard this life was. I think a lot of the aspiring young bakers out there that are going to go into the business don't realize what a commitment of over 100 hours per week.
Oh, it's
especially bread baking.
Yes.
And you make that distinction a little later in the book. Between cake bakers and bread bakers.
The aristocracy. The cake bakers are the aristocrats. They could come in at 7:30 in the morning. The bread bakers started at 10:30 at night.
That was very, very funny. I never thought about it that way. You think bakers are bakers.
Sure, exactly.
But what a hard life it is. And the humor in the book, so much of it is brought by Norman Berg, your co-author, who writes his Norman Berg Chronicles about what it's like, disasters that happen in the bakery.
Yes.
How, as a baker, it's a real narrow margin to make a profit.
Exactly.
You never, ever want to throw away an ounce of any ingredient.
Right.
And you retask and repurpose if mistakes happen, you make it work.
Exactly.
And his insights are just hysterical and brilliant.
Yes.
And at times heartbreaking about what a hard life it is.
And yet, I will say that having spent as much time with Norm as I have, both electronically and in person, and talking to him and getting to know him, he would not do anything else with his life. There is something so fundamentally satisfying about feeding the people you care about, feeding your community. And that's really the essence of being a baker. Which is one of the reasons that it was so central to Yiddish civilization in Eastern Europe. Aside from the fact that economic conditions required that most people's diet was 75% to 80% bread and grains, and so bread was fundamental. You know, people ate.
You said I think 2 pounds a day.
Yeah, average consumption was 2 pounds a day. But if you think about it, if you think about what we eat, most people will probably eat, raw, a pound and a half of protein.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Absolutely true.
In addition to other things. And, so bread was fundamental, not only to Jewish civilization, but to the society surrounding.
In that first chapter, that Vanished Worlds, you talk about the huge immigration in the 1880s through the 1920s when most Jews came to New York, and how one of the only professions available to them was to be bakers, and that they converted the basements into bakeries.
Yes.
That if you could put a brick oven in there, you were in business.
Right, exactly.
And how hard that life was. The black and white photographs in the book are very, very revealing.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because as I was doing research for the book, I found a report put together by the New York State Industrial Commission in, I guess it was about 1911, 1912, and some of the photographs were taken from that. And it discussed not only working conditions in the bakeries, but also in the sweatshops, the garment shops, and various other places where there were low-wage, severely exploited workers. Mm-hmm. And the occupational illness, the unsanitary conditions, just the brutality of having to live that way, was shocking even by 1912 standards.
Mm-hmm. But that was the first part, with tracing the vanished worlds.
Yes.
And then we get into about the recipes. And you, I've seen a lot of baking books, but I've never seen anything as thorough as far as measurement options. And you give not only in ounces, but in grams and the baker's percentages.
Right.
It's so thorough. Right. You have not dumbed the book down for a home baker.
No, not at all. Not at all. And in fact, we have gotten Joan Nathan, who is the doyen of Jewish baking, Jewish cooking generally, reviewed the book on tablet. And one of the things she said is you need to read the recipes through several times in order to make sure that you have it all.
So what you did, you took these original formulas from bakeries and then had to scale them down from hundreds and hundreds of pounds of raw ingredients to the home bakers.
Exactly.
So this took what? How many years did this took?
The book from start to finish, from conception. No, the writing itself actually took about a year. But it was a very intense year. Norm and I would generally spend, we had our weekly conference call on Sunday mornings, and we were normally on Skype or on the phone for anywhere between 2 and 3 hours.
It's absolutely remarkable, historically remarkable.
Thank you.
Let's take a break, and then we'll come in and go into the building blocks, and then bread from the land, and challah, and rye bread. We'll cover it all this morning.
Oh, wonderful.
In the KSRO kitchen is Stanley Ginsberg. He and his co-author Norman Berg have written Inside the Jewish Bakery. If you love to bake, obviously if you're Jewish, you're going to find a lot of this interesting and probably appropriate for your family history. But even if you don't, not Jewish, you're going to love this if you're a baker. Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking. One of you will win an autographed copy of this book at the end of the show. I'm Steve Garner. This is KSRO. In the KSRO bakery this morning with Stanley Ginsberg, Inside the Jewish Bakery, new in fall of 2011, Stanley's book, Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking. He co-wrote this with master baker Norman Berg, who still lives in Brooklyn.
The Bronx.
Yeah, pardon me.
That's okay.
So obviously, I'm not a New Yorker. The Bronx, not Brooklyn. And you now reside in Southern California.
I live in San Diego.
And you have a blog, by the way, don't you?
Not really.
Well, it's not a blog. You have a website.
But I have a website. Have a website for the book, InsideTheJewishBakery.com. Okay. And we have a lot of supplementary material, more information on equipment, on ingredients, and so forth. And we have also posted the inevitable mistakes that are available to download because... you know, it's important to get it right.
And I really commend you. We talked about this before we came on the air, that I wish all baking books and cookbooks in general would have an errata section on a website so you can access the latest updates and refinements and measurements that inevitably happen in a book that is as technical and precise as this book is. So people can, once they get the book, they can go to Inside the Jewish Bakery, and before they start, they can go online, look to see if there's any... deletions or additions or corrections to the recipe.
Exactly.
So thank you for doing this. I know publishers are not thrilled about this, but it's great that you take the integrity of the book to heart and really want people to be successful.
Yes, absolutely. I think, again, I think that the important thing is that these recipes be preserved the way they need to be. And it's important that people, when they do them on their own, that they have a good, solid foundation of success to build on.
So you started baking not only as a kid, but you continued on in college, I assume?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I went to graduate school at University of Wisconsin back in the 60s and 70s. And at the time, I was living in a co-op. And there were about 30 of us, and we split chores. And I was always the one who baked the bread.
Oh, right.
And it was, to me, it was just a great pleasure. I had one experience that I remember it must have been about 20 pounds of dough, this huge pile of dough on a counter in front of me, and I'm up to my elbows in it. And I was thinking and just sort of experiencing the universality of it, that people had been doing this very same thing for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it was something that allowed me to bond with my own past and with the civilization that I am a part of. And it was just one of those wonderful, extraordinary, timeless moments that has stayed with me ever since.
In the building blocks, you talk about the different flours, of course, the wheat, the rye flour, the proteins. This is rather technical, but it's really important. The barley, the potato, cornmeal, the yeast. That was a wonderful portion of the book. And then bread from the land, which you talk about the history, the hierarchy of the loaves, the Talmudic interpretations and definitions of what is bread.
Right.
So it's more than just someone deciding. This was prescripted by the rabbis,
bread sanctifies a meal. It turns a nosh. If you eat a piece of candy, right, the candy doesn't constitute a meal, but if you eat a piece of bread, the Talmud says if you eat a piece of bread the size of an olive, then you have to say the blessings over bread and you have to say grace after meals. And so what happens, the simple act of eating a tiny little piece of bread becomes a sanctified act.
Beautiful.
And it's just, you know, and again, it's something that is not only nourishing the body, but it also nourishes the spirit, and it connects with the community.
Sabbath means challah, and this is the first bread that's discussed in detail in the book. And there's a number of different recipes for challah, and there's a multiple ways of braiding, right, the challah. And you show that you have these illustrated in the book.
The interesting thing about braids and about braided challahs is that they originated in the 14th and 15th century among German Christians who braided their Sabbath loaves.
It's not an original Jewish invention, then.
I will tell you, quite honestly, nothing is an original Jewish invention. The Jewish bakery is really a kind of this accretive culinary history of our wanderings.
Mm-hmm.
From up from the Roman Empire, there was a dish, a layered bread or cake called floden, and that can be traced all the way back, you know, probably to the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And then there was movement north and west into France, and then into Germany, and then further east along in the Rhine Valley, and then as the Jews were expelled in the wake of the Protestant Reformation, were expelled from Western Europe. In the 15th and 16th centuries, there was a much more of a move into Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
into Poland, Lithuania, Eastern Austria, and what is now Czechoslovakia.
I love the point that challah was so important to celebrate the Jewish Sabbath that even members of the community would make sure that even the poorest family would have a challah for Friday night.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Really rallying around.
Again, one of the interesting things about challah is one of the reasons there are so many recipes is because there are very few other breads that I can think of that are not defined by their ingredients but are defined by their function. And challah is sanctified bread, and it can be anything. The one critical element is that the baker take a piece of the dough separately in remembrance of the sacrifices in the temple, and incinerated in the oven. And that, in fact, that is called, in Yiddish, it's called taking challah. Oh. And the little piece of dough that is taken for sacrifice in remembrance of the temple sacrifices is what sanctifies the bread.
On to rye bread. We could spend an hour just on rye bread, and this was a great, great chapter. You have the different kinds of rye breads, the history of rye bread. Rye bread was really the bread you ate 6 days a week, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it was the go-to bread.
The go-to bread.
Right.
It was inexpensive. It was filling. It kept you alive. And then, of course, challah for the special Friday night breads. And you talk about the corn rye, the old-school Jewish deli rye, the mild deli rye, the New York rye, the onion rye, the marble rye, all the different flours, how black bread was prevalent pre-World War II.
Yes.
The rye tips, you have a whole section, a whole page on page 60 about rye tips. How to make your own caramel coloring, which I've never seen in print before, which is an important part. How to get the shiny glaze on top of the rye bread. It is a great, great chapter. And also in that chapter is the baker's diary that Norman wrote about from 10:15 p.m. to 9 a.m., a harder day's night is what it's called. And that was really funny. He's a very funny man, this Norman.
Oh, he's hysterical. He is hysterical.
And so that's the entire rye bread section, and that we need to take a break at this point. Okay. Then we'll come back and we'll jump into bagels.
Good.
Some controversy there. Rolls, bialys, the pastries and cakes, and we'll take another break, and then we'll go into cakes and the history of the chiffon cake, which was fascinating, too, and go into Passover baking in the last part of the interview. Good. My guest today is Stanley Ginsberg. His co-author, Norman Berg, they have written Inside the Jewish Bakery, a book unlike any other baking book you've ever seen. Recipes and memories from the golden age of Jewish baking. I'm Steve Garner. This is Kim. Well, we dispatched rye bread and challah pretty quickly. Now we're back with bagels, and the new book is Inside the Jewish Bakery, Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking with Stanley Ginsberg, the co-author of the book. Boy, bagels have really fallen on hard times. They're just not what they were 30, 40 years ago.
You know, to me, bagels are a perfect proxy for the assimilation of Jews into the American mainstream. You know, I have to say, without sounding too critical, which I am, but without sounding too critical, is that if my grandparents were chewy and crusty, like a good bagel is, my kids and a lot of the children of my friends have turned into Wonder Bread.
Uh-huh. Amen. I was amazed to find out that there wasn't such a thing as the International Bagel Bakers Union.
Oh, yes. Local 338. These guys. And the interesting thing about it is it was harder to become a bagel baker than it was to get into medical school for a Jew before World War II. And
these guys were like the mafia,
yes,
of the
exactly.
bagel board, weren't they?
Exactly. If somebody in New York was baking bagels and they were not a member of the union, they would come and break their legs.
You're not exaggerating.
I'm not exaggerating.
These were the enforcers.
Yes.
So how did you become a member of the Bagel Bakers Union?
Very simple. You had to choose a parent who was a member. Or you had to marry the daughter of a member.
How many members were there?
At its peak, probably less than 1,000.
In the whole area.
In all of New York.
So, yeah. What happened to them?
Well, what happened to them? They got mechanized out of existence. A guy in Los Angeles named Mickey Thompson, Jewish guy, okay, had been working for years and years and years on developing a bagel-making machine. Up until that time, all of the bagels were made by hand. And in 1962, Thompson developed the first working bagel machine. And it was a guy in Connecticut, a young guy who had come out of the Army and took over his dad's business. His name was Murray Lender.
Well, sure, Lender's bagels.
Yeah, exactly. And Murray Lender was the first guy to mass-produce bagels. He was using hand rollers, but he was also packaging them in plastic, and he was distributing them through supermarkets and through grocery stores and all sorts of other places, whereas traditionally the only place you could get a bagel was in a bakery. And so he built up this huge business, and Mickey Thompson sold his first six machines to Murray Lender in Connecticut, who had it set up in what was at one time a garage, and they started cranking out these bagels, and that was really and that was the old story of John Henry versus the steam engine, right? And that's the story. That was the bagel the hand rollers disappeared, and the problem was that the members of 338 said, it's a fad, it'll pass, don't worry about it. Well, they got blindsided big time, and uh-huh. And that was the end of it.
Like the buggy makers with the car.
Exactly, or the slide rule makers, exactly.
So they were kind of just out of business eventually.
Yes, yeah.
And bagels fell on hard times because people's expectations of what a bagel was nothing like what it really was, unless you were in the New York East Coast area.
Exactly.
With the whole artisanal bread movement, and there's some, as you know, the most extraordinary breads we've ever tasted.
Yes.
Are there artisanal bagel makers anywhere? Are people trying to bring these back?
There are a few around. I know of a couple in New York. I know there is one. In fact, there is a marvelous video on YouTube of a guy that I know in Delaware, Wilmington, who it's a video of him. In fact, we have a link on the New York Bakers website, nybakers.com, where this guy is rolling 100 dozen bagels an hour.
Oh my God.
1,200 bagels an hour. And it is the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen. I mean, I clocked it. Okay. And, you know, and an average bagel baker at the peak of hand rolling could do probably 60, 70 dozen an hour. This guy was doing 100 dozen an hour. So there are a few around. But the interesting thing is that what happened, the downfall of the bagel happened as a result of the technology, because the machinery at that point dictated how the dough is going to be. Bagel dough fights back because there's a very low proportion of water to flour, mm-hmm. comparatively. It's just over 50%. So if you're using, let's say, 2 pounds of flour, you're using a little over a pound of water.
Got it.
And so it's a very, very tough, mm-hmm. resilient, elastic dough, and it fights back. Now, that's all well and good if you're doing it by hand, but if you try to put it into a mixer, it'll burn out. It'll burn the mixer. I burn mixers out, you know, big KitchenAid mixers doing bagel dough. So what happened is the first compromise is you add more water to soften the dough. All right. And that's going to change the characteristic of the bagel. Next thing that happened was the dough was too sticky with all this extra water. So they had to add oil to it so that it wouldn't stick to the machinery. Okay. Oil further softens the crumb of bread. And so all of a sudden, you've gone from this dense, chewy, wonderful, jaw-breaking circle of dough into something more resembling a commercial bakery bread with a crust.
Okay.
Now, once we started getting into the big bagel chains, I won't mention any names, who make their bagels in central commissaries, they've got production schedules that they've got to meet. So one of the other things that they dispensed with was refrigeration overnight. A classic bagel is refrigerated overnight to give the dough time to develop, to give the flavors and the flour time to break down from the starches into the sugars and so forth. But so what happens is they start adding chemical dough conditioners. Right, so that they don't have to rest the dough for 12 hours.
Well, but in your chapter, there's five ingredients in the bagel.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
It's water, it's yeast.
Flour, yeast, salt, and malt.
And malt, and that's it.
That's it.
And you get all the different recipes for how to make authentic bagels.
Right.
It's a beautiful chapter.
Thank you.
In the rolls chapter, we have that. Oh, and also there's an interesting thing about New York bagels versus Montreal, Canada bagels,
which is interesting
reading, too. There's the rolls section and the Bialy section, which I think most people have probably never had a real bialy. It's my favorite way to eat a bread. It's my favorite bread in the world, an onion bialy.
Yes.
And actually, you know something? There was a bakery that just a couple months ago in Los Angeles that I got a fantastic bialy.
Hmm.
I'll try to find out the name for
Please
it. But
do.
They have
Please
one
do.
Left, and it was tasted like the real deal to me.
Nice.
So, and then we're into the pastries and cakes section. And what an interesting page that was about the importance of cake crumbs.
Yes.
Who would have thought that this was an important ingredient to keep on hand at all times?
Exactly.
It's really interesting.
I mean, the most interesting thing about cake crumbs is that even lemon meringue pies, they would use a layer of cake crumbs on the lemon filling before they put the meringue on top to prevent the meringue from sliding around on the lemon.
Never would have thought of that in a million years.
Yes.
That was interesting. There's also, of course, puff pastry recipes, and I love your Blitz puff pastry.
Yes.
That's a great one, too. And then into the cake section, which is really miraculous, and especially the chiffon cake. And we're going to talk about that in our final section.
Good.
With me in the KSRO kitchen is Stanley Ginsberg. Inside the Jewish Bakery is his new book. He co-wrote it with Norman Berg. It's recipes and memories from the golden age of Jewish baking. I'm Steve Garner. This is KSRO. With our final 10 minutes or so with Stanley Ginsberg, he's our special guest today on the KSRO Good Food Hour. New book is Inside the Jewish Bakery, Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking. Lavishly illustrated full-color pictures throughout, lots of black and white photos showing you how to braid and assemble all these breads. These are master formulas long since gone from Jewish bakeries around America that he's laboriously gathered and, of course, reformulated so that the average baker can make them in their own home kitchen. It's a real labor of love, and also a lot of interesting stories about Jewish bakers around America and the history of Jewish baking worldwide. We've made it to the cake section. How did chiffon cake revolutionize the cake world?
Our chiffon cake is really very interesting because it was developed by an insurance salesman named George Baker.
His real name.
His real name was George Baker. And what he did was something, you know, one of these incredibly simple innovations that nobody ever thinks of. And then afterwards, they smack themselves in the head and go, why didn't I think about
dough.
It?
Dough.
Right. And he came up with this formula. And basically what his formula was he took a standard cream cake formula and substituted vegetable oil for vegetable shortening. So in other words, instead of using the solid white vegetable shortening, right, Crisco or something like that, he'd use vegetable oil, okay, and then folded in egg whites and so forth. And lo and behold, it created this very light, very moist cake. And he kept the recipe secret for about 20 years.
And when was this that he created this?
I'm sorry?
When did he create
this? Was
come
in the,
up with this?
This was in the 20s.
1920s.
The late 20s, right. And he kept it secret, and he was selling his cakes. He became a cake manufacturer, and he was selling his cakes to recipes. I believe he's from L.A. Hmm. And so he was selling his cakes to the Brown Derby and all over the place. Finally, in the late 40s, he accepted an offer from, I believe it was General Mills, Betty Crocker, to buy his secret formula. And I guess it was in 1949 or 1950, one of the women's magazines, Women's Day or Better Homes and Gardens, one of those, Family Circle, published the recipe. And at that point, it just took America by storm.
Mm-hmm.
By storm. Because this was restaurant quality cake. And this was also a time, understand, right after the war, was World War II, was when the first cake mixes came out. And
sure.
The first cake mixes were dreadful. I remember reading something where somebody said, described the cake mix as saying, the cake mix has enough baking powder to raise an anvil.
That's true. Well, that's why
yes.
You were successful.
Yes, exactly.
But you also pointed out not only were these marketed towards home cooks, but also huge manufacturing
yes.
concerns
oh, yeah.
went to these mixes.
Right. Well, they can go to the mixes now. And the thing is, one of the sad things, as food has become a mass-produced commodity, is that you no longer have to know how to bake in order to run a bakery. You can buy the same mixes that they sell in the stores. You buy them in 50-pound bags. They've got the same directions and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can get a minimum wage kid to mix up the batters. Cookies, you can buy them in 5-pound trays, 10-pound trays. You can buy the dough, the artisan breads already pre-shaped and frozen.
So you can have a bakery without an oven.
You don't need an oven. You don't need an oven. You don't need a baker.
Oh, sad.
And yeah, it is sad because one of the things, the price that we pay is we lose control over what we eat. We no longer have the ability to define what we like, but we have to compromise to what the food scientists say not only tastes good to focus groups, but also is cost effective and preserves the profit margin.
Sad. What about Aunt Lillian's apple cake? Was that your aunt or Norman's aunt?
No, actually, it's my wife's aunt.
Your wife's aunt?
Yes. Norm came up, Norm had an apple cake recipe. That was good, but it wasn't nearly as good as this recipe.
As Aunt Lillian's?
As Aunt Lillian's.
Well, I went right to it in the book because I love apple cake, and it's a simple recipe.
Yes, and it is a phenomenally good cake.
Page 182. It will be the first one I make out of your book.
Good.
I'm sorry I'm not going to go anything more complicated,
okay.
But
that's fine.
I live for apple cake. There's also great recipes for pound cake, plum cake, sour cream, coffee cake, honey cake, which is a very famous
yes.
cake, the wonder cake, the sponge right. cakes, of course, all the chiffon cakes,
well,
all
say,
of that.
Say something very interesting about the honey cake. Our honey cake recipe uses rye flour. It doesn't use wheat flour because this is a recipe from Poland, Lithuania, where rye flour was far more affordable and far more available. Now, the interesting thing about rye and honey is that both of them love moisture. And so the rye honey cake, which you bake for about 2.5-3 hours at low temperature at about 225 degrees, and it turns absolutely black. But after 2 or 3 days, it doesn't go stale the way a wheat flour honey cake goes. If anything, it gets softer, and there is a layer on the top that just becomes, it turns almost into this honey-flavored caramel. And one of the stories that Norm tells that didn't make it into the book was how one of the times he got very seriously in trouble, he and a lot of the other young bakers, because they would raid the honey cake and they would scrape this soft, chewy top off.
Well, sure.
You know? And they would eat that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, that you know, the owner of the bakery would come going, "What is this? What did you do here?
Really recommend people make the honey cake.
Oh, the honey cake is spectacular.
And also, this brings it a point that on your website you talk about many of the recipes and chapters that didn't get in the book.
Yes. Yeah. For, you know, simply
because of space considerations.
Yeah, the economics of publishing are such that, you know, when the book, the manuscript was finished, it was about 40% longer than it had to be.
Sure.
And so I had to take a knife, and as Hemingway said, I had to murder my children. But then our publisher said, "Listen, you know, you have this website. Why don't you just put it on the website so that people can, you know, people can access the information?"
No book on Jewish baking would be complete without cheesecakes, and that's the next chapter. Yes. And that's a very substantial. And I love that you have two pages on troubleshooting.
Yes,
because there seems to be a lot of problems with cheesecakes.
Well, actually, that's troubleshooting all cakes.
All cakes too.
You know, you have a cake that collapses. You know, how do you handle it? In fact, there is a website, and I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it's called, Cake Disasters or Cake Something. But what it is just photo galleries of these failed cakes, and a lot of them are bakery cakes where people just really mess up the happy birthday.
Uh-huh.
It's hysterical. It's just really very funny.
That's the cheesecake section, yes. And then into the cookies section. We don't have time, unfortunately, to spend a lot of time. But there's right. great recipes for rugelach, the one that really went mainstream,
yes.
the Jewish cookie that
yes.
went mainstream, and then the great section on Passover baking, which people should certainly look at before Passover in April,
yes.
because Passover sweets traditionally were inedible.
Right.
The stuff you get, isn't it true?
Oh, it's very
the mixes
true.
And all this are
it's
just
very
terrible.
True. Yeah, I mean, you know what you get is those gummy macaroons in the can.
Terrible.
And
terrible.
You know, and just that other horrible stuff. The you know the seven layer cakes or whatever.
Because the limitations are, you have to use matzah meal, matzah flour. You
right.
can't use traditional flour.
Right. And generally,
or leaveners, right?
Yeah. Generally, well, leaveners. You know, you can cheat it a little bit.
Oh.
Because you can use baking powder, as long as it's kosher for Passover,
okay.
baking powder. But also, generally, it's a combination of matzah cake meal and potato starch.
Potato flour, potato
right.
starch.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's a great chapter. You don't have to be afraid of tackling
right.
Passover baked goods.
Right. In fact, I was tuning up some of the Passover recipes and did some Passover eclairs and cream puffs.
That seemed to be one of your favorites. You're
yes.
like the eclairs, and
yes.
me
yes.
too.
Yes.
You can make that eclair dough out of matzo meal and potato
yes.
flour.
Yeah, basically what it is you heat up water and oil with a little bit of salt, and you just throw in matzo flour, and you heat the thing up,
mm-hmm.
and then you will stir in an egg, and then pipe it.
Mm-hmm.
And put it in the oven, and it blows up just like regular cream puffs.
Yeah.
And then, you know, let them cool, cut them open, fill them with kosher for Passover vanilla pudding or with whipped cream or, you know, what have you, and there you are.
You pointed out, it's really interesting, that most all bakeries closed during the whole
yes.
Passover
yes.
because how cost prohibitive it was to try to make every piece of, every bit of, yeah, the baked, they have to kosher it, don't
yes,
they?
Yes,
under
the
rabbinical
right. every and the last atom of leaven had to be removed from the bakery, and anything that was open, any bags of flour that were open, had to be taken out. And typically, what they did was sell it to a non-Jew ritually for a dollar, and then they would buy it back at the end of Passover.
Interesting.
But yeah, everything, the floors had to be washed with boiling water, the stoves and the ovens had to be blowtorched, the counters had to be washed down with boiling water, and everything had to be purged of anything that might have been yeasted.
Basically. You said maybe there was a couple bakeries in the New York area that would remain open,
yeah,
that would go through all that.
Right, right. Because, yeah, and as Norm puts it, the reason they did that was because they felt an obligation to the community. to provide. Now, one interesting thing, just generally, that he told me that I really didn't know was members of the Baker's Union, part of their union contract was that every baker get 2 loaves of bread a day so that the baker's family doesn't go hungry. And once a week, they could take X amount of cakes and pastries and things like that. But that was written into the Baker's Union contract.
Amazing. We did skip over the role section, and I know that's something near and dear to your heart. And you met Norman Berg by his phenomenal rye roll?
Onion rolls.
Onion rolls. You said onion that rolls. Was the benchmark. You knew this yes. guy was the real deal.
Exactly.
When you tasted his onion rolls.
Exactly. Exactly.
Then on to the ices and finishes, the fillings and toppings, everything you could ever think about that. And then the resources, which is great. We're fortunate in the Bay Area of having Giusto's and Central Milling here for great flours.
Yes.
But there's also mail order sources throughout, and also a list of all the blogs you like, the baking blogs, which is terrific, including, of course, your website.
Right.
The Inside the Jewish Bakery, that's for the book.
Right.
And then also you can order products from your New York baking.
Right. NYBakers.com.
And that. So all that resources are there. Now, you have to think about this for a moment. Your favorite number between 1 and 10 today.
My favorite number between 1 and 10. Do I have to tell you?
Yes, you do.
Oh, okay. Let us say number 6.
Caller number 6 at 636-1350 will win an autographed copy of this book I'm holding in my hand, Inside the Jewish Bakery, Recipes and Memories from the Golden Age of Jewish Baking, Stanley Ginsberg and Norman Berg. Hopefully we're introduced this to a whole bunch of passionate bakers that are listening to the show today.
Steve, thank you so much. It was
my
pleasure.
And thank you for writing the book.
Sure.
Be back next week. I'm Steve Garner in the KSRO kitchen.